One or two of you may have noticed that Barbara is not here today. There was a death in her family, so she's gone to Texas a little earlier than she had planned to do. Everything's okay. There was a lot more celebrating than grieving, but she is out there, and it would be good to remember her. If you would turn, please, to Leviticus. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus. And as we begin, I want to make sure that we all agree that there was a homework assignment last week. We do agree on that, right?
David started the study of the Old Testament, literally.
Good. Good. All right. Last week we looked at Leviticus 9 and 10, where the priests began their work, and we noticed that in chapter, I think it was 8 and 9, everything was going along okay, and in chapter 10 it all falls apart as the two of the sons of Aaron do some things in wrong ways. We do not know the specifics of what that involved, but we do know that they died as a result of that. If you take a look at Leviticus 16, verse 1, it will occur to you as you read that that sounds like that ought to follow right on Leviticus 10. Leviticus 10 is when those two sons died. Leviticus 16, the Lord is speaking to Moses right after that. And that's probably not a bad way to picture it. So the question is, what's happening in Leviticus 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 that interposes itself between these two reports? And the answer is important enough that we need to look very briefly. If you take a look in chapter 11, chapter 11 deals with clean and unclean where critters are concerned. Now, I'm from a part of the South where the word critter translates pretty well, but maybe you're not. They talk about animals that are clean and unclean. They talk about things that come out of the water that are clean and unclean. They talk about birds and bugs and insects that are clean and unclean. It's a whole chapter that talks about things that are clean and unclean. I'm having an interesting discussion right now. One of the people that I work with at UVA is a Jewish person who tries to keep kosher, and we've had a little discussion on this chapter this last week as I went to a Mexican place with him and had shrimp. he had chicken. Chapter 12 talks about clean and unclean that has to do with pregnancy and childbirth. Chapter 13 and 14, we have already talked about at some length. This talks about leprosy or contagious skin disease, my translation calls it. And it talks about parallel things in clothing and then parallel things in houses. Because we've talked about this on another day in another context, you're not allowed to forget that conversation on the other day, but I'm not going to repeat it right now. But that's what that can... So the clean and unclean with respect to leprosy and whatever the parallels would be in houses and clothes. You get to chapter 15, and it's talking about cleanness and uncleanness with respect to sex. And sex does turn up a bit. So if you take a look all the way from chapter 11 through chapter 15, it's talking about clean and unclean with respect to lots and lots and lots of different things. Some fairly high water pieces in chapter 13 and 14 when it's talking about leprosy. That's why we've talked about it already. Okay, so now chapter 16 starts. Now, your assignment last week was, before you came back this week, was to read chapter 16. Have you done that? Okay, so I'm going to begin by asking if you noticed the problem is reading, comprehending, and remembering. That seems to be the challenge for people. You can read. They used to say you can have, I forget what the three things were, but you could have any two, right? So you got reading, comprehension, application, and all that. You can have any two, it seems like, but getting all three is a pretty big challenge. Do you remember cleanness and uncleanness popping up in chapter 16? Well, I'd sort of like to start there. so that you can see this. But let's see that if the homework assignment has done any good. What's described in chapter 16? What's this event? What is this moment? It's the Day of Atonement. It is a day set aside for atonement. The word in my translation is expiation, which you might want to set alongside of that. Atonement is the more familiar word. Expiation is the other word. It talks about fixing things that have been broken in the relationship between God and people. And since sin is what's come in the way, then that means fixing the consequences of and the effect of sin. This is the day on which that happens. How often does this day happen?
Once a year.
How many years did this go on? It's supposed to go on forever. If you come to the end of this chapter, verse 29 and verse 34 both begin with, "This is a perpetual law for you," my translation says. This is a perpetual law. You're going to do this once every year. There's provision in verse 32 that when Aaron dies, his sons will take over. When they die, their sons will take over. When they die, their sons will take over. This is going to be passed on, father to son, in the priestly line. And this day of atonement, this day of expiation, this day of addressing the sin problem that blocks the relationship between God and people, this day will be celebrated, will be the things commanded will be performed. And this is talking about that day. All right? Everybody still all right with this? Okay, so the purpose is to fix the sin problem of people, right? Okay. Please take a look. I'm going to leave the context aside for a moment. We're going straight to the heart of it. Look at verse 16. For whom is the rite of an expiation, the activities of atonement, for whom are these conducted? If you go back into chapter 16, verse 6, it talks about the sacrifice is for atonement of the priest and for the priest's family. And then it talks about a little bit later that he's going to offer, this is in verse 11, sacrifices for the sin of the people. All that's already in place. But take a look in verse 16. What's the purpose? Mine says, this is how he must perform the rite of expiation for... Mine says the sanctuary. Yours says for the most holy place. And it goes on and says something very interesting. What does it say? For the uncleanness, or because of the uncleanness of the Israelites, for their acts of rebellion, and for all their sins. What does the rest of the verse say? Mine says he must also do this for the tent of meeting. Okay? If you come to the end of verse 17, when he has made expiation for himself, for his family, and for the whole community of Israel, verse 18, he must come outside, go to the altar before the Lord, and perform the rite of expiation for that. This is what people don't often notice. There is a process of making things right with God for the people, starting with the person who is leading, and his family, and then for the people at large. But there's also a part in this for a process of atonement for the worship center and for the places in the worship center and the things that are associated with the worship center. For the sanctuary, for the Holy of Holies, for the tent of meeting, and then for the offering, the place of offering for the altar. Does everybody see that? Okay, go back up to chapter 16, verse 16. This is how he must perform the rite of expiation for the sanctuary, for or because of what? The uncleanness of the people, mine says first. Their acts of rebellion and all their sins. Okay? Yeah.
I was at a wedding yesterday. It was the first time I'd ever seen it. It was at Memorial Church, which is right down on Broad Street next to MCV.
Yeah.
And in the actual whatever the thing they gave out at the wedding. It had stated that the church was unconsecrated, and I'd never seen that before.
That may be part of this, yeah. Okay. Mine has a whole bunch of fours in here. Does yours have fours in here? Now, in verse 16, it talks about the rite of expiation for the sanctuary. There's a period, and then it starts up again talking about, in my translation, the tent of meeting. I'm only going up to that first period, the one that talks about the sanctuary of the Holy of Holies. The first four perform the rite of expiation for, on behalf of, or towards the Holy of Holies. The second four, for, because of the uncleanness of the Israelites. Everybody see that? Mine then has a comma, and it says another for their acts of rebellion and all of their sins. There is not, in my translation, a last F-O-R. For their uncleanness and for their acts of rebellion and all of their sins. It lumps those last two together so that you end up with 2 points, not three. I think this is right. Does yours contradict this? Does yours have more fours in there? Okay. Does it divide into three? I think there's commentators who think dividing it into two is right. And I want to try to see if you can see this. The first one talks about the uncleanness of the Israelites. The second one, if I'm reading it right, talks about their acts of rebellion and all of their sins. Can you hear the difference between those two? Can you hear the difference between those two? There's a passage in Matthew that says, take a look at a tree. You're not going to get good fruit from a rotten tree. You're not going to get rotten fruit from a good tree. You can tell a tree by the fruit it produces. And then it says this, good people draw good things from the store of goodness in their hearts. Bad people draw bad things from the store of badness in their hearts. You can tell what kind of person you have by what you see. The first part of this, the uncleanness of the Israelites, is different from acts of rebellion and all of their sins. Can you hear the difference? One is talking about what you see in actions on the outside, and the other talks about what's going on inwardly. The act of atonement for the sanctuary is necessary because in their hearts, the people of Israel have an evil center. There is badness at their core, and that needs to be dealt with. And from that, they are doing bad things, and that needs to be dealt with. I want to make sure you see that. I think it's parallel to what you see in Jesus' words. Good people draw good things from the store of goodness in their hearts. Bad people draw bad things from the store of badness in their hearts. You can tell what kind of person you have by what they do. But what they do is arising from something that's inside. Hiding in this verse is a preliminary for all of that that the New Testament talks about. And I want to make sure you see that. Why is this necessary? Because God is holy and the people are unholy, and that has created a gulf. And by being around people who are unclean, that uncleanness has rubbed off. And once a year, you got to clean all those things. Now I want to pause right there and talk about something that I don't like. There's a commentator I read that I really liked the way he put this. He said, I like almost everything about spring. I like the flowers. I like the return of the birds. I like the pleasant air. I like the cool mornings and the warm afternoons. But I don't like spring cleaning. And he says the Day of Atonement is, in his mind anyway, something like spring cleaning. If you don't do it, the junk has accumulated to a point where it just overwhelms you. I don't know if that trivializes it or not, but it's a very interesting thought. What's happening is the accumulation of uncleanness over the year is dealt with. And it's dealt with not just on the part of the people, but it's dealt with on what's inside the people, on what's come out of the people, and on all the things the people have affected. Building the back into the worship center the cleanliness that is necessary for people to be able to come to God and be made right with God. Is this helping a bit? Did you see all this as you were reading through this? Rita?
Why would there need to be an atonement for Holy of Holies?
Because it is located in the midst of a people who are unclean. Let me take you back to Isaiah. Isaiah starts out in the first chapter with the prophet with his finger out yelling at the people on it because of all the things they're doing that are wrong. And it reaches a climax in chapter 5 when he puts his finger out and says, "Woe to those who..." And the list of things that he's talking about is awful. Those of you who've been in here and have heard me talk about this, how many times does the finger of the preacher, of the prophet, point and say, "Woe to you, woe to you"? How many times? Six times. And chapter 6 opens, and King Uzziah dies, and Isaiah goes up to the temple, and he has a vision of the Lord, and what does he say? "Woe is me." What does he say at that point? "Woe is me, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips." The worship center God has put in the middle of the people, but the people are contaminated. And that contamination has to be dealt with. That's the hidden part of this. I've not heard many people talk about this, but that's the hidden part. The other, I think, is more important. But if you don't see this underlying piece, you're not seeing everything that's there. Doing okay so far? Yeah? Okay. Unclean critters, unclean. And all of a sudden, you get to this part, and buried in the middle of chapter 16 is this part about we got to take care of the uncleanness of the people that is affecting the place they worship. And I want you to see that probably is the reason those chapters were there. Chapter 11, chapter 12, chapter 13, chapter 14, chapter 15. To give you a sense of where that big accumulation is coming from, it has to be dealt with. Okay? So, let's see what we've seen so far. Chapter 16 could have followed right on chapter 10 because it seems to do that. There's been an insertion, and the insertion is the sources of uncleanness all around and in the people. And that hiding in this chapter, not hiding bad, but most people don't seem to see it, is this idea of the uncleanness of the people affects the places they worship. And so once a year, that has to be dealt with as you deal with the sins of the people. Okay? So let's move back into this. If you will take a look at chapter 16, 1 and 2, it opens with a reference back to chapter 10. Don't just come into the sanctuary anytime you want to. Don't come in any way you want to. In case the priest incurs death. "For I appear in a cloud on the mercy seat," God says. And then starting in verse 3, it says how the priest is supposed to come in. Now, did you read verses 3 and 4 that tell you how the priest is supposed to come in? Mine says, "This is how he must enter the sanctuary, with a young bull for sacrifice for sin and a ram for burnt offering." And then it talks about his clothes, right? Did you read that? Yes or no?
Yes.
You read that. Good. Did anything jump out at you as odd? This is not the clothes that the priest wears. They got all that stuff that we talked about chapter after chapter back in Exodus that described the clothing. This isn't that. Those jewels that have three names on each jewel, the ephod and all that kind of stuff, none of that's there. What's this clothing? Plain linen. Close to it. It's very plain and very simple, where the clothing had been ornate and spectacular. Why is that? How many times a year do you do this?
Once.
How many times a year do you do all those other things? 365. Did everybody realize that the time changed last night? Is everybody aware of that? There was an extra second added. It took 61 seconds to get from 1 minute before midnight to midnight last night because the time had changed, right? So 365 days in a year plus an extra day that builds up every so often, right? One day a year, you don't wear the same clothes. Why is that? The splendid clothes are worn when the priest is representing God to the people. The simple clothes are worn when the priest is representing the people and himself to God. And that big shift hides that little fact. The Day of Atonement is not aimed toward the people to make God visible to the people and to build that bridge. That it's turning the other way. And the simplicity of the clothes is reflecting that. Okay? What does the priest, this is verse 3, what does the priest bring into the sanctuary? A bull and a ram for sin and burnt offerings, right? Okay, take a look at verse 5. What other animals are brought forward? Two goats and a ram. Where do those come from? Those come from the community. Now, I don't know, maybe the others come from the community as well, because remember, the priests don't have a portion in the land. All that hasn't been set up yet, but they're not going to have a portion of the land. But the priest brings these in. The people bring the other two. And they bring in one bull, one ram from the priest bringing it, and then they bring a ram and they bring two goats. Right? And they begin to talk about what they do. Verse 6, he offers the bull as a sacrifice for his own sin and performs the act of expiation for himself and his family. He then takes the two goats and does some things with it. Let's skip that for just a moment. And in that process, he is performing the rite of sacrifice or the rite of atonement for the people. And then there's things that you do for the rite of atonement or the act of expiation for the places. Okay? Yes?
Can I ask you a practical
question?
Go. I read this. They did not have email back then. How is it that the word got out? I mean, there are about 50,000 ewes and goats. Who brings a goat? Who brings a cow? Who brings all this stuff? How did the word get out so people understood what to do with all this stuff that is being told to Moses? Just out of curiosity. It's a practical question.
My first answer is, I don't know for sure. My second answer is, they had heard God's voice and they had gotten the idea this is probably something pretty important to do correctly. Moses has found out how to do it correctly and he's been reading this to them. I think the priests have now probably joined him in that. And I think there's sort of the leaders here and the sub-leaders here and you move it like that. Remember way back when they were coming out in the Exodus, when they haven't made it this far yet, Jethro, his father-in-law, came along and he says, you need to quit making all these decisions yourself. You need to appoint people over 1,000 and people over 100 and people over 50. Remember that? I think that system is probably in place to do that. But it is interesting. Okay. Now, let me see, there are about three things I want to see, and I'm trying to think which way to do that. There's a whole lot in this chapter. The focus of this chapter is on the goats. Has everybody noticed that? The focus in this whole chapter is on the goats. So let's dig into that. What happens to the goats? One of them is killed. And the blood sprinkled in the same place as the blood of the bull, inside the Holy of Holies on the mercy seat and in the other places on the altar. Okay? What happens to the other goat? He's sent out into the desert, but not until something happens with that goat. Okay? So let's follow that just a little bit. Chapter 7, chapter 16, verse 7. The priest will take the two he-goats, place them before the Lord, draw lots over the two goats, one lot to be for the Lord, one for, and it simply says Azazel, and that seems to be a name that would have worked at that time to say for Satan. Aaron will then take the goat on which the lot for the Lord has fallen and offer it as a sacrifice for sin. The other goat will be placed alive before the Lord for the rite of expiation to be performed with it and then be sent to Azazel in the desert. We don't know all that means, but jump over to verse 20. Once the expiation for the sanctuary, the tent of meeting, and the altar is complete, that's the part that I said a lot of people don't seem to notice, he will bring the goat which is still alive. Aaron will then lay both of his hands on its head, and over it will do something. What will he do?
Confess
the
wickedness and rebellion of Israel.
Okay, there's a very special word there.
All the iniquities, guilt.
The word is all. All. My translation says he will confess over it all of the guilt of the Israelites, all of their acts of rebellion, all of their sins. The word all is repeated three times. How long did that take? Was it done in summary form or was it done specifically? We don't know. Count your many blessings, name them one by one. This seems to be the opposite of that. He will lay both his hands on its head and over it confess all the guilt of the Israelites, all their acts of rebellion and all of their sins. Again, that's that same either two or three part section that we talked about back up in verse 16. It's either two parts or three parts. The guilt is that interior, the acts and the sins. Are the things, the acts are outside and then the sins may be in both places. Having thus laid them on the goat's head, he will send it out into the desert under the charge of a man waiting ready. And the goat will bear all their guilt away to some desolate place.
Why does that take the sins away? Put it on the goat and put the goat in the desert. So the goat takes all the sins into the desert and...
Got to make sure I got enough time. Hold that thought for just a minute. I want to take you someplace else. What if the goat comes back? What if the goat comes back?
Sin comes.
My mother-in-law had an infestation of squirrels. She had peach trees, she had fig trees, and she had squirrels. There was a constant battle. She did not win as often as she liked, and she finally decided the thing to do was to start a little export business. She put traps into the yard, trapped the squirrels, put them in her car, carried them a long way away, let them out, and went back home. This one day, she looks and says, I'm pretty sure that's the squirrel we trapped last week. He's back. My father-in-law said, can't be. I trapped it again. She pulled out a can of black paint. Painted its tail black. Or maybe orange or maybe red, I don't remember now. They took it a long way away. 2 days went by. They're sitting out in the backyard. And here comes the squirrel with the paint on the table. What happens if the goat comes back?
They have a man chasing
them. The symbolism says the goat doesn't come back. Number one, this is symbolic. Number two, it had a reality to the people and it seems to have had an effect for the people. For how long? For 1 year. And at the end of 1 year, what do you have to do? You have to do it again. Okay? The whole of what you're seeing, everything there, the worship center and everything else, is not the reality. This is from six or seven weeks ago now, right? What are these things? The sanctuary, the Holy of Holies and all that. What are these things? Models or replicas in earthly terms, of a reality that exists in heaven. In the model, in the replica, things can be done that show you something of what happens in the real thing. And they are effective for a while. And then they have to be done again in order to continue to be effective. Okay? What has to happen for sin to be dealt with? Focus only on the goats. Don't worry about the others right now. Focus only on the goats. What has to happen for sin to be dealt with?
Confession.
Something has to die. Blood must be shed. May I quote, for those of you who are in the 8 o'clock service, without the shedding of blood, there is no remission of sin. Right? And secondly, what has to happen? Because that's not all.
It has to be taken away.
The guilt that lingers has to be taken away. How far away? So far away it can't get back. A long way away. A permanent way away. Okay? That's what the people were being experiencing in the model that they were seeing. There seems to be an effect. The effect lasted for a year. Okay?
Back in verse 7, it called the second goat the scapegoat.
If it called the scapegoat in your translation, that is a good term to use. My translation doesn't use it, and most don't, but that is what it is. That's our term, scapegoat, comes from this concept. Okay? Look again. Two goats. What happens to the first goat? Dies, blood is shed. What happens to the second goat? Carries the sin and the guilt so far away it'll never come back. How long does this last? 1 year. Okay? 1 year, once a year, year after year after year after year after year. Yeah. Now, let me try to draw this little part together. Verse 23, when he has sent the goat into the desert, Aaron will go back into the tent of meeting and do what? Takes off the linen vestments which he wore to enter the sanctuary and leave them there. Not to be worn again for 1 year. He will then wash himself within the holy place, put on the regular vestments. The word regular isn't there, but that's what it means. And come back outside to offer his own and the people's burnt offering and perform the rite of expiation. Verse 26, the man who led the goat away, what does he do? Washes his clothes and his body before re-entering the camp. The bull and the goat that were offered as a sacrifice of sin, the blood of which was taken into the sanctuary for the rite of expiation, must be taken outside the camp where their skin, meat, and offal are to be burned. The man who burns them will
wash
his clothes and his body before re-entering the camp. The process that normally would cause uncleanness in the part of those who touched all these is also dealt with. So that by the end of the process, everybody is clean for once. Maybe then it's not just spring cleaning. Maybe it's also Saturday night baths. For some of you who are old enough, I understand that was one of the traditions out on the farm where maybe water was a little hard to come by. You'd bathe once a week and whoever was the youngest would get the freshest bath water or vice versa. I forget how it worked. But there's something here about starting the year with a clean slate. Letha, as best I can say, the process does that. But the process is saying something else. Who gets to go into the Holy of Holies? The priest, and only the priest. Nobody else. Verse 17, no one must be inside the tent of meeting from the moment he enters to make expiation in the sanctuary until the time he comes out. And there's some verses like that scattered around here and there. Everybody okay? Nobody goes in except him. He is the only one who goes in, and he goes in at this time. Everybody all right? What does he do when he's in there? Verse 12. He fills a censer with live coals from the altar before the Lord. That's the incense altar that's inside the tent of meeting. He takes two handfuls of finely ground aromatic incense and brings this inside the curtain. He puts the incense on the fire before the Lord so that the cloud of incense hides the mercy seat which is on the testimony, and thus he does not incur death. This is not a good parallel, but it's an effective parallel. So forgive me for using a good but ineffective parallel. Have you seen beekeepers at work smoking a hive? Okay. The mercy seat is not in plain view to the priest, because the priest puts a cloud of incense there, and dimly through the cloud he sees God's presence, because that's where God is. One person meets with God in that place, in that way, and once a year. Okay?
Didn't they put bells on the bottom of the road?
There were things that they did. We are told by tradition that they put a rope around them so they could be dragged out if something happens to them while they're inside. Okay. Let's see if there's anything else I need to say. Yeah, one more thing. Two goats. What happens to the first goat? Slaughtered and sacrificed, blood is shed. What happens to the other goat? Set free, but set free in a way that it carries all the uncleanness away, far away, where it can't come back. Is there any place else in Scripture where a sacrifice of that kind is set up? Two animals side by side. One dies and the other goes away someplace. Any place else? You read it two chapters before this one. It's in the middle of the leprosy section in chapter 14. It's in the middle of the leprosy chapter in 14. Take a look at Leviticus 14, verse 2. This is the law to be applied on the day of purification of someone who has suffered from a contagious skin disease, but who isn't anymore. Such a person will be taken to the priest. The priest will go outside the camp. If he finds on examination that the person has recovered from the disease, he will order the following to be brought for his purification: two live birds that are clean, some cedar wood, scarlet material, and hyssop. He will order one of the birds to be slaughtered in an earthenware pot over running water. He will take the live bird, the cedar wood, the scarlet material, and the hyssop, and dip all of this, including the live bird, into the blood of the bird slaughtered over running water. He will sprinkle the person to be purified of the skin disease seven times, and having declared the person clean, he will what? Set the live bird free. If you don't understand that there's a connection between leprosy and sin, this one makes it clear. The only place in Scripture where you see this. Okay, we now have 10 minutes left, maybe 8 minutes left, and that's maybe enough time to go to Hebrews. Because if we don't go to Hebrews when we're talking about this, we are missing half of the story. Have you found Hebrews? Chapter 4. I think most of what I need to do is just read a little bit. And you see if you can follow along with me. I'm going to start at chapter 4, verse 14. Bobby, that was for your benefit, to help you find it. Chapter 4, verse 14. Chapter 4, verse 14. You okay? Everybody more or less ready? Since in Jesus, the Son of God, we have the supreme high priest who has gone through to the highest heaven, we must hold firm to our profession of faith. The high priest we have is not incapable of feeling our weaknesses with us, but has been put to the test in exactly the same way as ourselves, except that he did not sin. Let us then have no fear in approaching the throne of grace to receive mercy and to find grace when we are in need of help. Every high priest is taken from among human beings and is appointed to act on their behalf in relationships with God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sin. He can sympathize with those who are ignorant or who have gone astray, because he too is subject to the limitations of weakness. That is why he has to make sin offerings for himself as well as the people. No one takes this honor on himself. It needs a call from God, as it was in Aaron's case. Now in verse 11, he starts saying there's a whole bunch of stuff we need to say that's really deep, and I'm not sure all of you are ready to take this, and maybe you need to grow up a little bit, but we'll skip that section and jump right over to verse 19 in chapter 6. See how this fits with what we've just seen back in Leviticus 16. This is the anchor our souls have, reaching right through inside the curtain where Jesus has entered as a forerunner on our behalf, having become a high priest forever of the order of Melchizedek. There's a long period of time where it talks about what that means. But let's come to verse 23 in chapter 7. The former priests were many in number because death put an end to each one of them. But this one, that is Jesus, because he remains forever, has a perpetual priesthood. It follows then that his power to save those who come to God through him is absolute, since he lives forever to intercede for them. Such is the high priest that met our need, holy, innocent, and uncontaminated, set apart from sinners and raised up above the heavens. He has no need to offer sacrifices every day as the high priests do, first for their own sins and only then for the sins of the people. He made his sacrifice once and for all by offering himself. If you come to chapter 9, it begins to describe the picture of the holy places that we just talked about. Talks about the holy place in verse 3. It talks about the Holy of Holies in verse 3. Now take a look at chapter 9, verse 8. This is what we've been building to. As long as the old tent stands, the way to the holy place is not opened up. It is a symbol for this present time. None of the gifts and sacrifice offered under these regulations can possibly bring any worshiper to perfection in his conscience. They are rules about outward life, connected with food and drink and washing at various times, which are only in force until the time comes to set things right. But now Christ has come as the high priest of all the blessings which were to come. He has passed through the greater, the more perfect tent, not made by human hands, not of this created order. He has entered the sanctuary once and for all, taking with him not the blood of goats and bull calves, but his own blood, having won an eternal redemption. Verse 15, this makes him the mediator of a new covenant, so that now that a death has occurred to redeem the sins committed under the earlier covenant, those who have been called to an eternal inheritance may receive the promise. Verse 22, according to the law, every purification takes place by the means of blood, and if there is no shedding of blood, there is no remission from sin. Verse 23, only the copies of heavenly things are purified in this way. The heavenly things themselves have to be purified by a higher sort of sacrifice than this. It was not as if Christ had entered a man-made sanctuary, which was merely a model of the real one. He entered heaven itself. Verse 26, he has made his appearance once and for all at the end of the last age to do away with sin by sacrificing himself. Now, let me see if I can help you understand this. There is a place in Matthew, chapter 27, verse 51. Don't go there, just write it down and look at it later. Where it says, at the time Jesus died on the cross, something happened inside the temple. What happened? The veil or curtain that separated the Holy of Holies from everything else, that curtain was rent in two from top to bottom. It was about 30 feet tall, I think. It was open. All of a sudden, the way to the Holy of Holies was open for everybody. In the priestly system, the Aaronic system, the one that we just talked about in Leviticus 16, one person once a year goes inside with the sacrifice, one person and one person only. When Christ died, that separation is taken away and everybody goes inside. You and I can approach the mercy seat. We approach the mercy seat by approaching Jesus. The pictures in the Old Testament are powerful for what they do. What did Jesus do on the cross? In his death, it was the sacrifice for sin. And in his death, our guilt was taken so far away it will never come back. Those two parts of what happened are all done. And that's the power of Leviticus 16. Let's have a word of prayer as we finish. Our Father, we thank you that long ago you began to prepare a people for the one sacrifice on the one day that worked once and for all. That now that that sacrifice of your Son has taken place, all of us have the right to approach, not just a representative and not just once a year. All of us can approach. We do not understand all that this means, but we understand this much. The way is open for us to approach you without fear, but in confidence. Our Savior, your Son, stands beside us, and the path has been opened by his death, and he is with us by his resurrection. We pray that you would give us insight into all that this means, teaching us that we no longer need to fear your wrath because we have received your mercy, and we can now be free to begin to work and act as children of yours. For we pray all this in your Son's name.